From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, comedian Julia Sweeney, the former cast member of Saturday Night Live, has a new film adaptation of her one-woman show, God Said Ha. It's about coping with her brother's diagnosis of cancer and then discovering that she had cancer, too. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the British band Gomez. You've probably never heard of them, but you've probably heard them on a TV commercial. And TV critic David Bianculli finds the connection between ER, Stephen King's The Storm, and the impeachment trial of the president. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her days on Saturday Night Live, Julia Sweeney was best known for her character, Pat, whose gender was always ambiguous. Now Sweeney is best known for her solo show, God Said Ha, about having cancer. Sweeney adapted the show into a book and into a movie of the same name. The movie opened today in New York and Los Angeles and will open in other cities over the next several weeks. As New York Times critic Peter Marks wrote, Sweeney has found the showcase for her real calling, storytelling. The story she tells begins after she left Saturday Night Live and moved to L.A. Her brother Mike, who also lived there, developed a vicious form of cancer and came to live with her. Her parents also soon moved in to help care for him. And as her brother was close to death, Sweeney discovered she too had cancer. While all this was happening, Sweeney was reporting on it every Sunday at a comedy club in West Hollywood called Luna Park, in which the rule was you couldn't tell a story you'd ever used on stage before. Those Luna Park monologues were the basis of God Said Ha. In 1996, when she performed her show on Broadway, Julia Sweeney performed an excerpt for us.
We were all continuing to help Mike in all of his different therapies, and he was doing really well, with the exception of the Spinal Tap chemos. Mike had received so many Spinal Taps that scar tissue had built up along his spinal column and they couldn't access it anymore. So one day we were at UCLA and Mike was on the examination table and my brother Jim was there and myself and my mother and my father, who was reading a 50,000 word essay in the New Yorker all about the plague in India, you know, as a diversion. And the doctor came in and he said, Mike, this is what I suggest. I think that we should put a shunt into your forehead, which is a plastic opening, so that we can put the chemo directly into the cranial fluid. So, you know, this was just awful. And Mike immediately said, listen, doc, if you think you're going to put a faucet into my forehead, you may as well give me a lobotomy at the same time. And there was this awkward pause. And then my mother chimed in, and she said, oh, Mike, I don't think it's like a faucet. I think it's more like a spigot. And then I think even the doctor was a little embarrassed, and he said, Mike, let me just tell you that my patients who have the shunts, well, they love them. And Mike said, oh, they do, do they? Well, then by all means, give me a shunt. And Mike did get a shunt, and after that his refrain became, I love my shunt. And whenever the doctor would come in the examination room, he'd say, how you doing, Mike? And Mike would say, I'm not doing too well, doc, but I'll tell you one thing. I love my shunt. And to just show you how surreal things were getting, at night, the whole family would watch shows like ER and Chicago Hope. And whenever anyone would come into the emergency room, Mike would yell out, give them a shunt! They need something to love.
An excerpt from Julia Sweeney's God Said Ha. I wanted to know if she was ever superstitious about turning her brother's fatal illness into comedy.
No, I guess I've always seen the comedy in horror, you know, in the horribleness.
Sounds like your brother did too.
Yeah, our whole family kind of has that attitude, I think. I didn't really realize that until after this experience, but it always seemed very natural because it wasn't like we were somberly going through the day at the hospital and then I was turning this somehow into comedy later. We were laughing too. You know, I mean, my brother and I were, I mean, we weren't in a constant state of laughter, obviously, but there were, I mean, there was terrible things. I don't want to downplay that, but there was also very, very humorous things that were happening, you know, because of the coldness of the hospital or because of the special warmth of some particular nurse or something. You know, there was always something that we found, you know, something we found to giggle at. And so it seemed like those things were the things that I put together for Sunday.
So after all these Sundays of just explaining that your parents had moved in with you indefinitely and how uncomfortable that was, how did you, you know, show up and then explain to the audience, well, the reason why they moved in is that my brother is very sick?
Well, I just thought I just have to come out and say it and not, you know, trying to make a huge deal out of it and just kind of go on, because I realized that the underlying context of my brother being ill and my parents there helped the stories really be funnier. And it was also clearer why I couldn't vent or something with my parents because of my brother being ill. It just added, there was like a big part of the story that was missing by not revealing it. And so finally I said, oh, my parents are staying with me indefinitely because, and I got very nervous. It's embarrassing for me to remember. And I said, oh, because, well, my brother has cancer. Ha ha ha. But he's doing really well. And he's very, has a great sense of humor about his own struggle. And we're very close and we're all rooting for him. But here are some of the things that drove me crazy this week about the hospital. And then I would go on like that.
Now, what was happening in your life when your brother Mike got sick?
Well, actually, one thing I don't even reveal in my show because it's so horrible, I don't think the audience would believe it, seriously, is that the weekend I found out that my brother was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma was the same weekend that the Pat movie had come out in Seattle and Houston to, you know, disastrous reviews and no attendance by the public. And so it was this very awful weekend. I was just separated from my husband and, you know, I was kind of getting used to being alone. And then this movie was coming out and I was doing all this publicity. And then on the big weekend where it came out and I was getting facts after facts in Seattle of one terrible review after another, then that Sunday night I found out about my brother being ill. And so my whole life in one weekend just changed. And I don't actually put in the part in the show about the show's getting bad reviews because, in truth, it became so inconsequential. Once Mike was sick, who cared about the movie and who cared about the reviews?
Now, how did he and how did you feel about your parents moving in with you?
Well, you know, I say they were with us for 9 months during the show, which it was over the course of 9 months that they were with us most of the time, but there were a few times where we really just sent them back to Spokane because we really had enough. And also my brother would go through periods of time where he felt really great, and sometimes he'd drive himself to radiation, and you know, having cancer doesn't mean you're sick every single second, you know. And so we would send them off and then they wouldn't be able to stand it and they'd have to come back. And you know, it was very helpful on the one hand because there's so much to do when someone's sick. I mean, there's really a lot of things that must be done. On the other hand, it's your parents doing these things for you again, and you suddenly feel like a child, and, you know, they're trying to help you, and they are pretty much helping you, but they're driving you crazy also. So we were both commiserating and appreciative all at the same time, all the time.
What are some of the things your parents did that would make you feel like a kid again when they were in your house?
My mother, she feels that when she's in her house or the house of any of her children, that everything is fair game. For example, if she wants to reorganize the second drawer of your bathroom, she feels that she should be able to do that. And not only do that, that she's doing you a great service. And so sometimes you would come in and there would be all of these little, you know, Q-tips and safety pins and some Sudafed, and then it would be all over the counter, and then she'd be saying, now why, you know, this should be in the medicine cabinet, and you take a little paper cup and you can put all your safety pins in it, that's what I do when I get my dry cleaning back, and then it goes right there and I always know when I need a safety pin. And you know, you say thank you and then you try not to strangle her.
Now, did you turn into someone different when your parents were living with you? Did you turn into the child version of yourself?
Yes. In fact, sometimes I would notice my posture would change immediately. Like, suddenly I would feel, I would slouch more, and I almost feel like guilty for being taller than them or something. Like, we physically had to suddenly reorganize ourselves so that, you know, I was looking up to them somehow, physically.
Were you ever with them when you were recognized as, you know, hip Saturday Night Live performer, and here you were feeling like a child because you were with your parents and you're slouching to be more like their height?
Well, it's so funny because when I first got on Saturday Night Live, my parents, they didn't really know what that show was, and it was on way too late for them to watch. So they weren't particularly impressed when I told them I was on the show. But then people would start to recognize me, and that's when they liked it. Then all of a sudden, they knew all about that show. And so then, like, sometimes, you know, I would be with my mother, and she would want to dwell in the moment of the person recognizing me. She loved that moment. So if we were at the hospital and a nurse said, oh, you know, didn't you do that Pat character? And I would say, my usual response was, oh, yes, thank you very much. And now down this hallway is this, or change the subject. And my mother would go, yes, she did. You know, in a long, more drawn-out way so that we could enjoy that moment. So that was also slightly frustrating for me.
It sounds from your show that you really spent so much time with your brother while he was sick, taking him to treatments and just commiserating with him and trying to make him more comfortable. Had you been very close before?
We were close, but we became very close when he got sick. And it's hard to say. I mean, there's five of us kids, and I feel equally close to everyone. And in some ways, it seems really, really close, and in some ways, I wish it were closer. And Mike lived very close to me in Los Angeles, and he worked at the Groundlings Theater where I had also been performing, so I saw him all the time. But he really had his own group of friends, and I had my own group of friends. And then when I was on Saturday Night Live, sometimes in the summers, he would come and stay in my apartment in New York City, and so we kind of switch locations in the same apartment. So we were close in that kind of territorial way, but we didn't become really close until he got sick. And in a way, I'm really, really thankful that I got that time to get to know him like that.
Did he ever come to the club where you were performing the monologues about him?
No, and I so regret that because I think he would have enjoyed it. But at the time, I was so embarrassed that I was doing this. It was really naughty of me to me that I was rushing off to this club and telling these stories. And even though Mike and I were in on much of the comedy about our parents driving us crazy, I still felt like it was too public and I was kind of embarrassed about it. And I didn't really talk to him that much about it either. And I regret that now.
So it felt naughty, huh, to be doing that?
Well, you know, it's like you spend the week with your parents and then you get that 15 minutes on the phone with your best girlfriend. It's like that. And then you just burst. And then you tell everything that's driving you crazy. And then, oh, you're there. They're coming in again. I have to go. And so it was that. That was my 15 minutes on Sundays.
Did your parents ever want to come and watch you perform?
Yes.
Would you tell
them? They didn't know. I just told them I was going out for drinks with some friends. Oh, I'm revealing myself to be very delusional to people or trying to elude the truth. But, yeah, I would just say, oh, you know, I was performing improv at the Groundlings, too, on Thursday nights. And so they didn't really understand the difference between doing an improvisational show, you know, where you're making up stuff on stage with other actors, and doing this kind of storytelling type show on Sunday night. So I just made it sound like it was more like an improv show, and they probably wouldn't enjoy it.
My guest is Julia Sweeney. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Julia Sweeney. She's just made a film adaptation of her show about cancer, God Said Ha. While your brother was sick and your parents were staying with you, you started to see somebody, a man uh-huh. named Carl. And what was it like to have to almost sneakily have a relationship in your own home after you had already been married for several years? Did you feel like a teenager all over again?
Yeah, it was, well, of course I was so angry about it to begin with, because in September, I had met Carl. He's the brother of a friend of mine, and he'd come down to visit me, and we'd met. But it was, you know, we just met. And, you know, we spent some time over the weekend together, but we were just getting to know each other. Then he went back to Pocatello, Idaho, where he was living, and we started talking on the phone. And, you know, I figured we were pretty interested. And then we started really talking on the phone a lot, and it seemed very, very interested. And then he said, you know, I'm going to come down for a visit. And, you know, it was in the middle of all of this stuff that was happening. It was actually, I was doing a benefit for Mike in L.A., showing the Pat movie at the Directors Guild. And so, you know, Carl, you know, drove down from Pocatello to L.A. And, it was like, so that's September to February, and we're on the phone a lot together, and it seemed like things were going to heat up. Like, this was the weekend, right? And, you know, my parents are there. And it was so frustrating because I thought, I'm finally this woman that I all wanted my whole life to be, which is, you know, I'm single, I'm in my 30s, I own my own home, you know, and I'm ready to have these sophisticated adult relationships that I always believed were possible. And then I finally have this guy that I'm really attracted to, and then, you know, my parents are there, so we're having to, you know, kind of like sneak around and kiss in the hallway. It was just seemed so absurd to me. But what I didn't expect was that it was incredibly exciting, and it added this kind of, you know, hotbed of titillation having my parents there that I would never have felt if they hadn't been there.
Because we were sneaking around. Oh, because you're sneaking.
Well, you're sneaking around. You know, it's like, you know, I'd have been so many years since I thought, oh, I hear somebody walking down the hallway. Or I'm sure, you know, it's the same excitement that people must get from having an affair or something. It's like you're sneaking around. It adds this incredibly exciting element to the proceedings that you would never feel if, you know, the world were your oyster and you could do whatever you wanted.
Well, I have to say, though, that in your monologues, although you joke a lot about how uncomfortable it was when your parents moved in with you for such an extended period of time, you obviously really love them. You know, that's always clear.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that there were moments when, like, I would be coming back from the store with my dad, and it would be 9:30 at night, and it was just like a Thursday night or something, and there was no more plans for that night, or we all had to get up and go to the hospital the next day, and I loved it. I mean, I loved it having them there. I mean, it took a while to, you know, kind of break me into the new idea of them being there, but after a few months, I liked it. I mean, I kind of liked that I came home and there was a big group there to hear about what had happened, or I was there to hear what had happened to them, and we were all in this big mission of trying to take care of Mike, and so we had a agenda, and we had information to give to each other, and we had, I miss it. I miss it terribly.
When your brother knew for sure that he was close to death, did he talk with you about what he wanted when he died?
You know, he never talked about dying. He never did. And I think Mike believed he was going to make it until really the very, very end. I mean, there was a point at which he lost his speech and he was writing notes saying, let's try these new experimental chemos. He was trying, you know, so hard to do anything to try to combat this illness. And we never had that resigned conversation of, oh, you might not win this battle. And when we all realized that he wasn't going to win, we didn't talk about it with him. Or, I mean, we all just felt it, I believe.
You say in your show that your parents sent a priest to deliver last rites. Did he want that?
No. Well, you know, he had a complicated relationship to the Catholic Church, like all of us children have. And, you know, it's like there's certain tenets of the church that intellectually we cannot abide by, yet the ritual is so attractive and it's so much a part of our cultural heritage. And so we were always riding this line between not wanting things like a priest to come to the room and then being very comforted by the priest coming to the room. And So by the time my parents wanted Mike to get the last rites, but they don't treat it like a last rites like you see in the movies where you're just rushing in on the moment of death. They even call it like it's a sacrament called, it's not like reconciliation, which confession is now, but it's like you're getting better or something. And, you know, it's like it has a positive spin on it, you know. And so it's not to make the patient feel like this is the end, but, you know, let's, you know, join with God to try to help you get better. And so, but on the other hand, it's also the last rites. So when the priest came, I was a little bit mortified because I didn't want Mike to feel uncomfortable by this priest coming in, clearly to give Mike the last rites. Clearly our parents sent him. And I was actually a little defensive, and I arched my back a little bit and probably wasn't as friendly to the priest as I might have been. And then after he received the last rites, then, you know, Mike turned to me and said, actually, I was glad. I'm glad he came. But that's all he said, and I didn't push it because I got what he meant.
Julia Sweeney, recorded in 1996. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. Sweeney has adapted her show about cancer, God Said Ha, into a new film. The movie opened in New York and L.A. today and will open in other cities in the next few weeks. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Julia Sweeney. Ken Tucker reviews the debut CD by the British group Gomez, a band you've probably heard on a TV commercial. And David Bianculli finds the connection between ER, Stephen King's The Storm, and the Senate trial of the president. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with more of our interview with Julia Sweeney. She's adapted her comic monologue, God Said Ha, into a new film. It opened today in New York and Los Angeles. The monologue is about what happened after she left Saturday Night Live and her brother was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer. He moved in with Julia, and soon her parents moved in too to help care for him. Julia, the real kicker in this story is that you were diagnosed with cancer yourself. When,
yes.
When did you get the diagnosis, and what was your brother's situation at the time?
Well, Mike was not doing well. He had had a shunt put into his forehead so they could put chemo directly into his cranial fluid, and that was a horrible thing, although it was supposed to help him. And, you know, it wasn't like we knew he wasn't going to make it, but it didn't look good. And then right in the middle of it, I get diagnosed with cervical cancer, and it had spread to the point where I needed to get a radical hysterectomy, and they wanted to, you know, all sorts of radiation. So it wasn't, it was, you know, sort of a big deal. And, oh, it was just the worst timing. I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it.
Did your doctor know that your brother was very sick with cancer?
You know, this is not going to make him sound like a very compassionate doctor, and I actually liked him very much, but I kept saying, I was compulsive about saying, you know, my brother has cancer. Well, this is pretty strange because, you know, my brother has cancer. Well, you know, my brother has cancer. My brother's staying with me. He has cancer. And the doctor was going, well, you know, what kind of cancer? And I would say lymphoma. And he'd go, well, that's not related to cervical cancer. And I'd say, but, you know, I mean, but still, I mean, you know, it's cancer though. And this is really bad timing, you know? And, he didn't seem, I guess when you're a doctor and you're diagnosing cancer a lot, it doesn't seem so profound to you when two people in a family are having it at the same time. And I remember when I got my morphine or whatever it was, just before I went under for my hysterectomy, the last thing I said to the guy was, my brother just passed away. My brother just passed away. Because Mike had passed away 3 days before my surgery. And sometimes I look back on that and I think, wow, what that guy must have thought. Like, I was just such a mess, clearly.
How did you break the news to your parents that you were sick now?
Well, I actually postponed it for a little while because I felt so guilty about it. I felt, you know, I mean, they'd gone through so much and they were so upset and they were trying so hard and they were doing so well. And now, you know, I was being the strong one and we were all staying in my house. And then I just knew it would be a big deal, obviously. And so I tried to wait until it was really for sure. Everything, all the tests were in, it was just going to happen, you know. And then I told them and they, you know, their eyes filled up with tears. And then my mom and dad went for a walk around the block and, oh, it was a bad night.
What was it like to have them there when you were sick?
Well, it was actually, it was great having Mike there because he would tease me relentlessly about he would say that I had a cold compared to him, which was true. My cancer was so much not like his cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, oh, you just have a little sympathy cancer. And he would say, oh, you know, now you can join me in the cancer spotlight. And he would say, you know, you get served a lot faster in restaurants when you mention you have cancer and so forth. You know, and we really became comrades at that point.
And what about your parents? You're so funny in the show. You say all the other girls got to have their hysterectomies without their parents staying with them.
Well, you know, weirdly enough, I have a couple of girlfriends who are my age who, for various reasons, one because of cancer and one just because of other sorts of problems, had to have hysterectomies. You know, in their 20s, and during that time, you know, they were. You know, one was married and one had her friends around, including me. But I didn't remember a lot of, you know, the parents being there every minute. And so I thought it was so weirdly ironic that I was in this situation saying to my parents, you know, my friends who've had hysterectomies, they didn't have their parents there. They got to go on their own to get it. And it was just like, what's happened to this world?
Did it help you get through things, do you think, when you were sick yourself, did you go back to the Uncabaret and talk about yourself?
Oh, yeah. And it was a lot easier then.
Why?
I mean, well, because, you know, I feel a lot more comfortable talking about myself in that situation than I was talking about Mike and my parents, because even though I spoke of them sympathetically, you are getting up and telling stories about people who aren't there. You know, there is something about it that's a slightly, you know, naughty, as I said, or offensive. And so when it was me, I felt this kind of free rein to really just go nuts talking about it. And I was really graphic about it, actually. And there's a lot of tapes from the UNCAB that I could never do in my show because of the nature of my illness that were really surreal moments. And it was a great therapy for me to be able to get up and vent about it. And I think it seemed to be interesting anyway.
Sure. Whenever you have a problem that's a quote female problem, the opportunity for absurdity in the medical world really enters into things.
Oh, I know. Yes. Well, and you spend your life making certain, your reproductive areas of your body are supposedly very private and,
delicate and
delicate. And then all of a sudden, you're just plunged into this situation. I mean, I'm sure it's very much like having a baby, where you're in front of God and everybody, as my mother would say. And, but then it was this, it was the cancer too. And then about not being able to have kids was all, and people would just say appropriate or inappropriate things. And it was just, I found it hilarious, but anyway.
You know what I'm wondering? When you're on stage talking about your brother's cancer, your brother's death, your cancer, your surgery, your recovery from cancer, so much of the angle that you see these stories from is the absurd angle, the funny angle. On the other hand, was there ever a time when you surprisingly, I just started to like choke up, when your eyes just started to tear up, when all of a sudden everything that you managed to find to laugh at slipped away and you were left with just the tragedy, the sadness of it all?
Oh, yeah. In fact, while I was writing it, it was never as tragic and difficult as during certain moments while I'm performing it. And in Los Angeles at the Coronet, there would be always a different moment in the show where I didn't know if I could go on. And I didn't want the audience to see me getting choked up, even though I just, I don't want to be cold and callous about it, but I didn't want to break down, And it was never the moments that you'd think. It wasn't necessarily the moment when I, talk about how, Mike died or when he died or anything. It was like, it's like all of a sudden I'll say we were scoping the hallways for the cutest doctor. Then I'll suddenly be so in that hallway, or when I turned to him, or when I was looking at the LA Weekly and I was reading an article to him, and suddenly it's so real and I can smell it and it's like a virgin memory, and then I don't think I can go on.
But you do.
But I do, yeah. Yeah, it's different times in the show and different memories. And not every show. Some shows I don't have that feeling. But a lot of shows I do.
I'm reminded of what singers often say, which is when you're singing a song, the singer shouldn't be the one that's crying. It's the audience that should have tears in their eyes while the singer just sings the song. Do you feel that way?
Yeah.
As a performer, that you shouldn't have to actually feel that much what it is? You shouldn't be the one who tears
up. Right. Well, I think that people are emotionally affected by my show because I don't go there.
Yeah,
I don't
break down
by the and I let them. Because when someone cries, it kind of takes the relief, it relieves the audience of having to, or letting themselves feel that way. And it happens just amongst people. If you're in a room with someone crying, you don't necessarily join in. It's like they're having the emotion for you. And I definitely feel that way in the show, that it isn't, it wouldn't be as good of a show if I did cry. And also, I feel as a performer, it's not my responsibility to go up there and just throw myself into all of the saddest parts of it in a real way. I'm there to perform because I'm trying to let the audience go through this experience. And it's better if I don't break down and cry, and I don't.
My guest is Julia Sweeney. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Julia Sweeney. Her show, God Said Ha, has just been made into a movie. It's about what happened after she left the cast of Saturday Night Live and her brother was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer. Then, as he was dying, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. You know, I have a whole different view of you now. I used to watch you on Saturday Night Live, and I didn't always have a really strong sense of you, you know? And now I've fallen in love with you as a character. Do you know what I mean? It's such a great I know it's you, but it's such a great like character you've become on stage. I just think it's really interesting that after being a public figure on Saturday Night Live for a while, that you've now revealed such a kind of personal side of your own story and such a funny way of telling it. I mean, I feel like I understand your sensibility so much more than I did in the Saturday Night Live years.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed being on Saturday Night Live, and it was a big break for me, and it was very exciting, and it was thrilling when Pat became popular, and, you know, it was also frustrating in the ways that everybody knows about. But it wasn't really me, you know, it wasn't... I feel fortunate that in this sort of venue I'm able to get my real point of view across in a way that I was never able to on that show.
Was the success of Pat a blessing and a curse for you? Somehow on Saturday Night Live, sometimes when a character takes off, you have to just like do it and do it and do it, even when you don't want to do it anymore.
Well, it was pretty much all a blessing. It really was on that show because it was difficult for a woman to get material on or anyone to get material on. There was a lot of cast members. Mm-hmm. And when you had a hit character, you had, you know, people wanting to work with you. I mean, it was hard. Like, after the first 2 years of doing it, it was hard to think up sketches for Pat. But it was exciting when someone, you know, like Roseanne came in and said, I want to do a Pat sketch, you know, and it was exciting when Harvey Keitel wanted to do a Pat sketch. I mean, that was a great, great situation to be in on that show.
How'd you come up with the character?
Well, I you know, I was an accountant before.
You were?
An actress, yes. For 5 years, I was an accountant at Columbia Pictures. And when I was there, there were a couple of people who I kind of melded together to become Pat in my mind. One person drooled a lot. And another person stood way too close to you and was always asking you to go to lunch, and you never wanted to go. And so I kind of mushed them into a person, and then I started doing that person at the Groundlings. And then when I got on Saturday Night Live, I continued doing it, and it was popular.
Well, how did the gender confusion aspect of the character come into play?
You know, it was such an accident, and I wish, you know, in retrospect, it was a genius idea, but in reality, as the idea arose, it was just out of expediency, because I was trying really to be a guy, even though these two people, one's a guy, one's a girl, that I was basing it on, but I was really trying to be a guy, and I just wasn't really doing it very well. And so they, you know, I thought, well, you know, maybe the way to get around this lack of acting ability I seem to have is to really make this gender thing confusing to everyone. And so, you know, people won't say, you know, she really doesn't seem like a guy. So I added that element in, and then, of course, it became the most popular element.
The gender confusion.
Right.
Are you ever going to do Pat again?
I would under the right circumstances. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not dreaming about jumping into that fat suit again. But I mean, it's not like people will say, oh, I bet you say you'll never do that character again. Or you know, Pat is dead. And I'll think, oh, you know, I have great affection for Pat. And I loved making the movie. I mean, I stand behind that movie. And I loved every minute of it. So I don't know. Maybe not anytime soon.
Julia, how's your health now?
Well, I guess it's very good. I keep going back to the doctors sooner than they want to see me again. And right before I moved to New York, I went and got all of my CAT scans and blood tests, and then everything came back fine. They said, okay, well, you know, come back in a year. I said, really? Don't you think I should come back next month? And they said, not really. You look fine. So I guess I'm fine.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, you're performing your show on Broadway.
I know.
How does that feel to you, to go from a comedy club to a Broadway stage?
I can't believe it. I can't get over it. I have to not think about it because I can't believe it. But, yeah, on Broadway. I was, you know, when I was on Saturday Night Live, I go to Broadway shows all the time. I was really in love with the theater. And I always thought, oh, I should have dedicated my life to being a Broadway actress. Oh, this is the most wonderful thing. Oh, this, you know, will never happen for me. And now here I am, kind of becoming a Broadway actress, I guess.
But instead of doing Chekhov, you're doing Julia Sweeney.
Yes, exactly. It's not exactly Chekhov. But, yeah. And we were actually looking for off-Broadway venues, and it was... we were finding it very difficult to get into an off-Broadway theater, and then these Broadway theaters were empty. There was a few. So at the beginning, it started to seem like it was just by default that I was going on Broadway. And my friend Al Franken kept joking with me, saying, you know, I hear if you do well on Broadway, you can make it to off-Broadway. And so, but now that it is Broadway, I feel like I'm rising to the occasion. I feel like, you know what, this is a Broadway show. So, you know, that remains to be seen, but I'm feeling very Broadway-ish.
Well, this time your parents will have to come see the show, yes?
Oh, this is a fight that's still going on. You know, they saw the show in San Francisco when I did it there, and I warned them vehemently that they weren't going to like it, and I kept saying, you know, I make fun of you on stage, I get laughs at your expense, I don't think you're going to enjoy it, I can't imagine a more worse situation to be in an audience with a bunch of people laughing at something I'm saying you said, and oh, I think you're not going to enjoy this. And then my mother called me and said, you know, we can handle a lot. And I thought, that was the greatest thing. And they came to San Francisco and they saw the show and they loved it.
Julia Sweeney, recorded in 1996. I'm glad to say her health has been good. Her movie adaptation of her show God Said Ha just opened in New York and L.A. and will open in other cities over the next few weeks. Next week on Fresh Air, beginning Tuesday, we'll feature a series on cancer, focusing on the latest cancer research and how to inform yourself if you have the disease. Coming up, a band you probably know only from commercials. This is Fresh Air. Gomez is an English group whose debut album, Bring It On, won this year's Mercury Music Prize, voted by British critics and music industry figures. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that if you're familiar with the band, it may be from an American TV commercial that's brought the group unexpected attention.
Gomez consists of five guys from Bristol who turned out Bring It On, a low-key CD that harks back to the American rock and R&B influences they've cited in interviews. ranging from John Lee Hooker to Lynyrd Skynyrd to Taj Mahal. It's a pleasant laid-back collection, one that was released a few months ago here in America and went nowhere. Listening to it, you can't imagine cuts like this burning up American radio airwaves. But then Gomez did something else. They cut some music for an American TV commercial. It's a spot for Philips TVs, and it features Gomez lead singer Ben Otwell croaking through a little bit of the Beatles' Getting Better.
I've got to admit it's getting better.
Flat TV from Philips.
Gomez's album was a big hit in England, where it's perceived as a return to roots rock, a sort of homegrown second coming of Creedence Clearwater Revival. It's the kind of thing that only the British ears can divine. But Bring It On was dead here until that commercial. The Philips Corporation says it's getting literally thousands of calls every day wanting to know who's that guy singing the Beatles song. Guess what? The band says it may record the tune on its next album. Maybe it'll give them the leg up they need to become as big here as they are in England. Or maybe the commercial will have been played so much on TV that we'll all be sick of Ben Otwell's voice before Gomez even gets a second album out. Call me cynical, but so are they, and I'm betting on the latter scenario.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, says that all of a sudden, television is providing some sense of closure to some very long-running stories. Many people may not see a connection between the Senate impeachment vote, George Clooney's imminent departure from ER, or next week's six-hour Stephen King miniseries. But David does.
Okay, so maybe it's a tenuous connection. But I don't think so. Even though one is from real life and infinitely more important than the other two, they're all different forms of the same TV genre. Stephen King's Storm of the Century, which premieres Sunday, continues Monday, and concludes Thursday on ABC, is a classic miniseries in the strictest sense of the term. At 6 hours, it's longer than the usual TV long-form dramas these days. Most of the time, today's long-form dramas run 4 hours, then run away, rather than risk spending too much money and airtime if viewers end up rejecting them anyway. Storm of the Century also is original for television. It's the first time King has created a story especially for TV, rather than adapted one of his existing books, and that'll probably encourage lots of people to tune in. King's TV miniseries have done well over the years, even though most of the people watching already know the ending. With this new story, the ending and the scares truly are a mystery. This may be King's most popular TV drama yet. By the way, it's also one of his best. Colm Feore plays a sinister figure who visits a remote island in Maine just before a major winter storm arrives. The storm isolates the island residents from the outside world, and that's when this mystery man, who seems to know all the town's deepest secrets, begins to take lives and take charge.
Your town is full of adulterers, pedophiles, thieves, gluttons, murderers, bullies, scoundrels, and covetous morons. And I know every last one of them. Born in lust, turn to dust. Born in sin, come on in.
What? Most King miniseries fall apart at the end, but Storm of the Century actually comes together. It's the third and final episode that's really creepy and makes the story so haunting and effective. The bad news is that ABC has scheduled that final episode right smack against NBC's ER next week, the show in which George Clooney makes his last appearance as Dr. Doug Ross. The reason this matters so much, at least to loyal fans of the show, is that ER, like most quality dramas on TV since Hill Street Blues, isn't really a weekly series at all. Not in the sense that they used to be, where one week's story was pretty much independent from the one before and after it. With ER, it's been one continuous storyline from the start, like a primetime soap opera, or, and here's my point, a very long miniseries. So when Doug Ross got in a car accident at the end of last night's cliffhanger, it was the most recent screw-up in a series of missteps that goes back years. Like Reed Diamond's character of Mike Kellerman, who left homicide life on the street in disgrace, Clooney's Dr. Ross is a good guy undone by some bad moves. Next week, his past finally catches up with him and offers a nice sense of closure that TV in the 90s provides us every now and then. Finally, speaking of some sense of closure, there's today's Senate vote on the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. This, too, has been a TV miniseries. Longer than most, with longer speeches and a lot more sex talk, but a miniseries nonetheless. And without getting political, I'll just end by saying that ER and Storm of the Century have come up with some very dramatic endings to their long-running storylines. And 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Finding Hope in the Age of Melancholy by David Aubrey, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Randy Newman was just nominated for 3 Academy Awards for his music for Pleasantville, A Bug's Life, and Babe, A Pig in the City. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear an expanded version of our interview with Randy Newman. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.